Oh, snaps.
The world is finally waking up to the crap that's baked into and sprayed on kibble dog food. No longer can commercial pet food manufacturers fool us with pretty pictures and false promises. This is the raw dog food truth. The view and opinions expressed on this podcast are not intended to replace medical advice. Before starting any raw diet, do research, ask lots of questions, and consult your vet.
Well, good Friday morning, Raw Dog Food Feeders. I am Dee Dee Mercer Moffitt, the CEO of Raw Dog Food and Company, where your pet's health is our business and we're friends. Don't let friends feed kibble. Friday is Dr. Judy Jasek Day. Good morning, Dr. Jasek.
Good morning. Good nice weather morning. Isn't it beautiful? Yeah, feels like spring. I got spring fever.
I know. I have flowers in the house that I weather over and they're blooming. They're like, I knew it's spring. But if you put them outside right now, they will die because we are supposed to get some more snow here in the next couple of days, right? And they say up here where I live in Evergreen, you have to wait until after Mother's Day to put your plants back out and to get your, you know, get your deck all in shape. So I still have a couple more months to go.
Yeah, I know. This is what's tough in Colorado is we'll get this little teaser, gets up to 70 degrees, and then we'll get another snowstorm. Like, ugh, we're not done. And then it'll get warm again. And then you can get snow easily through mid-May, even a little later in May. The snow doesn't last long, but it can still get cold enough to kill your plants, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I still have snow on the ground right now up here, so it hasn't thawed out. But anyway, let's talk not about cold. Let's talk about something that's hot. And I tell you what's hot is the subject of mistletoe. Mm-hmm. And you just did a talk with Dogs Naturally on Doctor's Rounds this week. And so I want to talk about mistletoe, why people might be afraid of it. You know, people are, they're afraid of things. Here's the thing. I still get asked, is it FDA approved? Who cares what the FDA thinks at this point? I think that they're criminals, but okay. You know, I had someone say, you know, are your products AAFCO? No, they are not. And they will not be, right? Because that's a kibble standard. Mm-hmm. But so what we always look at, you look at, I look at all the true health professionals, they're going to look at what really works for that which I'm treating, right? And what do my patients think? How do their bodies react? So you've had great success with mistletoe. Mistletoe is used for people. Tell us more about mistletoe, why you love it, what it does for the dogs, and why somebody might choose to use it.
Yeah, I agree with you on the whole FDA thing, because I think they're so corrupt that FDA approval doesn't mean anything, because they're bought. They're just bought by the industries making the stuff. So approval, it means nothing, because companies can buy approval, and they do. And that's, you know, the way it's done, whether people want to acknowledge. Like you said, I look at clinical evidence, and I look at, you know, our, you know, research that's been done somewhere else, like i.e. out of this country. And mistletoe has been used extensively and is still used extensively in cancer patients in other parts of the world. Like in some European countries, like 85 to 90% of human cancer patients will get mistletoe. So there's a ton of evidence on the human side. And we can get reports from people, because people can say, this is how I feel when I get mistletoe. And then of course we can see the ultimate effects on the cancer. And when we're treating cancer, of course, we're doing multiple things. You know, we're not just doing one thing, because there's never, ever, ever a magic bullet. But we start with good nutrition, and then we add in other things to support the body. And what mistletoe does, so mistletoe is an immunomodulator, which means that it helps get the immune system operating optimally. So it's not about suppressing it, like, you know, a lot of the drugs, say, you know, we have a patient with lymphoma, had two new clients yesterday, back-to-back lymphoma cases. Unfortunately, we see a ton of this. And so things like prednisone, which is immunosuppressive, or some of the stronger drugs, they will suppress the immune system and make the lymph nodes go down in size. You think, oh, great, you know, we're having success. Well, you're really not, because all you're doing is changing the appearance of those lymph nodes, and you're not doing anything to treat the underlying issue, which is dysregulation of the immune system. And I think a lot of this happens with over-vaccinating, as we've talked about. So what mistletoe does is sort of wakes up the immune system, and it actually can cause a slight fever. We're actually looking for a slight reaction because warming is beneficial. When you get sick and you get a fever, a lot of people will reach for the Tylenol, the ibuprofen. Oh, I got a fever. I got to make it go away. No, the best thing you can do is go lay in bed and let your body, you know, fight or do whatever it needs to do. Detox. It's just trying to cook something out of you. And a lot of the enzymes that help your body to detox, that temperature increase revs them up. So your body's cleansing mechanisms and, you know, the immune system work better sometimes at a higher temperature. That's why you run a fever, and yeah, it knocks you on your butt, because that's the whole idea. You're supposed to be resting, allowing your body time to heal, letting the fever do its job. And people report when they experience these mistletoe fevers, they say they like feel better than ever after coming out of it. Not, I mean, even if the target is to reduce cancer, I mean, just in general, like a general sense of well-being and you know, finding their sense of purpose in life, all this emotional stuff, clearing emotional traumas, people report.
I need some mistletoe.
I know. I want. That's what I'm thinking. I'm like, I gotta take some of this stuff. But then I'm like, okay, but if I take the mistletoe, I want to do it when I have a day that, like the next day, I don't have a whole lot going on in case I have some sort of reaction or I do run a slight fever. I'm like, I don't have days like that right now. So right. I need to schedule a day off so I can, you know, experiment with some of the stuff. But yeah, it's very, very, very interesting. And I have found, I mean, I've been using mistletoe for probably three to four years, maybe now. I really think it's improved our success in treating cancer patients, because I know, you know, we're seeing patients improve that. I tell you, 3 or 4 years ago, I'd be like, I don't know that we can get on top of this case, but now we're starting to see at least some stabilization where the pets have a good quality of life. We have actually one osteosarcoma patient now that is completely off of conventional pain meds and has completely quit limping. First time I've ever seen that happen. So these things do work. They do have, you know, effect, and it's not FDA approved. So there you go.
That doesn't
mean anything, but you know, these chemo drugs are, but I tell you, they make pets so, so sick. You know, I mean, I see cases where, you know, pets are on chemo and, you know, they'll say have a tumor removed, they do the chemo, the tumor regrows, you know, the body is so run down from the chemo, and then it regrows with a vengeance. And then there's very little we can do. And dogs get super sick on chemo where they're vomiting. We have one patient now hasn't been able to hold down food for like 2 weeks. But what's interesting to me is it's hard for people to acknowledge that it's coming from the chemo, that, you know, that the chemo actually does make them sick, because I think the oncologists tell them differently. Like there's only benefit to the chemotherapy, but that's not true. It does make pets sick. And I think in the long run, you don't get good results. So when we do things like mistletoe in conjunction with ozone and the nutrition and all these other things, and we can just like kind of kick that immune system in the butt and get it working better and more efficiently. I think, you know, that's where we could really have the best successes. And mistletoe is also real interesting because, you know, so this is a parasitic plant. I think there's just some really interesting parallels, because mistletoe, it's a parasitic plant. It doesn't send a root directly into the soil. It just taps the nutrients of the tree that it's growing on, you know, which kind of like cancer, you know, kind of cancer feeds off its host, and so does mistletoe. And it also, it blooms. It's in ancient times, it was known to be a magical plant because it blooms in the wintertime, blooms and creates berries in the wintertime. That's what you see it at Christmas. You know, it's the stuff you smooch under, you know.
And where did that come from? Why would you kiss under a parasitic plant?
Do not know. It does not sound like a great line on a date or anything. Hey, would you kiss me underneath the parasitic plant?
I mean, it must, it's a narrative that took hold and it's senselessness. And okay. We're still doing it today.
There's so many things like that in our world. Like nobody knows really why we do certain things.
Because you know, we're told to do it.
Because we're told it. So it's just like, I heard, this has been a number of years ago now, that actually poinsettias are not poisonous. That all started when a toddler, a little boy or girl, got sick and the toddler had been found with the plant and they assumed that that's what made the toddler sick, but it, you know, it ended up, it was something else. And it's just not true that poinsettias are toxic. So
really,
there you go. Yeah. I heard that a number of years ago, that was disproven after all those years of, you know, warning people. And, you know, probably ornamental plants probably aren't the best thing for your pet to be eating. So when, you know, it's still exercise some caution, but yeah, I heard a number of years ago that they're not actually toxic. So,
you know, that is one thing that Asta does. My oldest German, she likes to eat plants. She always has, you know, she likes to eat grass too, but she likes to eat plants. And I don't know, maybe I need to give her some more green Rover, give her something more green to eat.
Yeah. She might need a little extra green. I mean, what I tell people, and people ask, oh, I need to be adding, you know, produce in. And I kind of gauge that way how the pet likes it. Because I have some people that tell me that if there's vegetables in their dog's food, they won't touch it. And I say, well, I mean, their bodies don't need it. They don't want it. So don't feed it. I don't think it's necessary nutritionally, but I think it can help like feed the microbiome sometimes and just give that little bit of that plant fiber can help the bacteria in the gut grow. But I think the animals will pick plants that their body needs. And that's why they go out and eat grass in the springtime. Cause they're like, oh yeah, I've actually heard there's a certain type of a lactobacillus bacteria that's good for the gut that grows on grass. And that's one of the reasons why dogs with an upset stomach crave grass, because they're craving this probiotic. I'm like, well, that's like really the first thing first reason for dogs eating grass that I've heard that actually makes sense.
Right.
Cause
right.
Everything else I'm like, yeah, I'm not sure why they do that, but oh, could their bodies be craving that? And cause I've noticed even with my dog, as soon as stuff starts greening up and, you know, stuff starts sprouting up in the garden, whatever's volunteering from the year before, man, he's out there nibbling on those young spring plants. And yeah, they're probably doing, you know, replenishing their microbiome, doing a little spring cleaning in the gut, little detox. So they know it's good.
Yeah. It's amazing to me how many nonsensical reasons though we put on our dogs, right? So we say, well, they're eating it because their stomach is totally upset and they don't like this food or whatever. I mean, maybe they just like the food. Or someone recently was talking about, you know, again, the bones, which I sent them to your article again on bones. These are sharp bones. I said, these are rabbit bones. These are rabbit and duck bones, one of the softest bones, and they're raw. Well, the last time I took my dog in to get an x-ray, they saw bones just in the stomach. And it's like, okay, that doesn't mean anything. It means that they, you know, they're there being digested. But if the dog wasn't having issues, we just kind of put these fear things on our dogs. And I was over getting Asta adjusted yesterday at Dr. Andy's. And she was saying, we have the sickest, most neurotic dogs in the world right now. And she said, it was just hilarious. I mean, she had me in stitches because she was talking about, you know, we put these dogs in their Chanel coats and we don't let them go outside. And we make sure that they you know, have these cushy beds and they're neurotic as heck because they're not dogs. We're trying to make them into people.
Dogs want to be dogs. They don't want to be humans in dog suits. They want to be dogs. Yeah. Then we want them to be people. They want them to be, I think sometimes like you want, people want their dogs just to be their best friend or their perfect mate, you know, and that's not really why they're here. They're good companions, but I agree. I think fundamentally dogs are happiest when dogs can be dogs.
Yeah. Let them lick their butt. Okay.
Let them get their feet. Let them get their feet muddy. I noticed, Wiley, I've been taking him out. There's a little lake not far from my house and I take him there and he loves it because, you know, it's got all the smells because there's wildlife there. There's lots of birds and stuff. And I mean, he'll just go, he's 15 and a half. So our walks are more like just sniffs, but we don't go very far, but he'll go and he'll just like, he'll go walk out and kind of stand in like the, in the mud, you know, and just put his head up there in the air and just stand there in the sun and just sniff. He's like, oh, this just feels so good. I got my feet on the ground and all the new smells. And that's like living for him, you know, like then that's not fun for me, but he seems to be enjoying himself. So I'm like, I'm going to let him, you know, do what he likes to do. But yeah, and you got to look at like what dog breeds are meant to do. Like, you know, you have German Shepherds, you know, those dogs need a job to do. They're not happy laying around the house.
No,
you know, and you know, they want to be working. They got stuff to do. Or you got a herding breed, you better be ready to keep them busy because they're not going to be happy. And then, yeah. Why do we have separation anxiety? Because dogs are not meant to sit in a crate 10 hours a day or even be home by themselves 10 hours a day. You know, they're just not, they're pack animals. They're not meant to do that. They need activity. They need other dogs. And I agree with that statement by Dr. Andy. And I think COVID just made it so much worse. I can tell that the dogs that people got during COVID that never left the house because they have no socialization and they're afraid of their whole world because, you know, they go out in the world and they haven't been outside of the house. And then people are wearing these face diapers and like, what the heck is this? Like they don't understand, you know, what's going on. You know, dogs need to get out and they, you know, yeah, they need to be dogs, not people in the dog suits.
Well, and I see this when a blend doesn't have the exact same color as the last time they got it, right? Or it's just, you know, they want a pure raw dog food to look exactly like a commercial dog food. Or they worry, oh my gosh, it's not, you know, it has to be this perfection for my dog. And I'm like, you do know if your dog was out hunting, right? That they would be getting things with maggots and all this, you know, fur and animals that, you know, aren't sterile. I mean, it baffles me sometimes. I did that podcast not too long ago where I talked about how far we get from the real thing, right? And sometimes people will say, well, this looks like it has freezer burn. Okay, I'm telling you, your dog doesn't know what freezer burn is, right? Doesn't have a clue. So it's just funny that we've got to let them be dogs.
If you showed somebody a picture of like an elk that a pack of wolves took down, well, that's laying there out in the dirt for a couple of days and they're feeding on it, you know? Well, it's not a pretty sight, you know, and it's covered in dirt and all this other stuff. And it's certainly not refrigerated. And yeah, there's flies and all kinds of stuff coming to help feed on that. Those wolves aren't dropping dead from that stuff. And they're not that far, you know, this whole business that, oh, our domestic dogs have evolved. No, they haven't, you know, they're still meant to eat that fresh meat, and they're scavengers. They, like you said, they their bodies, if they're healthy, they should be able to go out and eat roadkill.
Yeah.
With maggots.
Absolutely. Bring on the maggots.
Little extra protein.
Right. Mm-hmm. Hey, so back to the mistletoe. I wanted to ask you, how does mistletoe treat cancer? You have some great points right here on your website, where you talk about the amazing history of the health advantages. Like one, you say that it prevents tumor metastasis. So if you have a dog that has a tumor, you know, because that's one thing that people really freak out about, right? Tumors, and are they going to grow? And is it, you know, cancerous and that sort of thing. If you do the mistletoe, they're meant to shrink those. And have you seen them shrink or at least stop the tumor from growing?
Well, we definitely see tumors shrink and stop growing. And it's, you know, again, we're doing multiple things, but I do think we've seen an improvement in our results since we started using the mistletoe. But again, it comes back to the immune system. So when you talk about preventing metastasis, well, metastasis is, you know, I always consider cancer a systemic disease. I think the way that conventional medicine looks at a tumor is like, well, if we make that tumor go away, we've treated the cancer. We haven't, because that tumor is just the tip of the iceberg. And I look at a tumor and I say, so what's going on in the body that this tumor was created? Because something's way out of balance, the fact that the body created this tumor. And so I'm looking at underlying causes. Well, the immune system, you know, a healthy body should be able to eliminate abnormal cells. So cells mutate, cells that could turn into tumors, the immune system should be able to eliminate them. So the immune system is not working properly. And what the mistletoe does is, again, it sort of wakes up the immune system, you know, getting this slight fever going. And sometimes there'll be a little reaction at the injection site. There'll be a little tender because the body is waking up. And as we wake up the immune system, it can eliminate these abnormal cells. And then because this growth is abnormal, and I think sometimes it's the body walling off toxins, or, you know, there's some other sort of inflammation. You know, I've heard it said that parasites can cause tumors to grow and all sorts of things. I mean, I think there can be lots of reasons why the tumor ultimately forms, but the bottom line is the body is out of balance and our immune system is out of whack and not functioning properly. So it's really from that perspective that it works. So we're helping the body get on top of the situation and manage the situation. It's not about attacking the tumor, because when you go at it, well, we just got to get rid of this tumor, and you're just focusing on the disease and you're not focusing on the patient. And that's what conventional medicine does. And you don't have good results with that.
Yeah. It's so crazy that is the narrative, right? The narrative is all we got to do is attack that one spot, take it out, and we're good to go. And that doesn't seem to work very well. And so it's very difficult for us to change again that narrative in our head. I had Neely Piazzi on for the last couple of days, and she was talking about, again, terrain theory, right? The mm-hmm. terrain. So yep. what you're saying is exactly that. We got to keep the terrain as clean as possible with water, with food, keeping toxins out. And that's the area that we talk about day in and day out on this podcast, because I think it takes a long time to change the mindset. And the question, you know, that I said to Neely, and I think I've said it on this, what toxins can you put in the body that are going to increase health? Right. I mean, it's tough. There's always going to be a side effect to putting a toxin in the body. Right. Mm-hmm. So we got to keep those out of the body, but I like this mistletoe a lot. I like the idea of heating up the body with the fever, and fever scare people to death. I just had one of our customers who had a dog who was running 105 and not eating and throwing up. Okay. However, the vet put this dog in the hospital, and couldn't figure out what was going on with it. They thought it had leptospirosis, ran the test, did not have leptospirosis, but they decided to throw antibiotics at it just in case. And also the liver enzymes were going up. So, you know, I'm thinking they're trying to bring that fever down, but You know, I remember Dr. Jasek when Asta had that 105 for 3 days, and all we did was keep the fluids in her, keep her paws wiped down with rubbing alcohol to cool her down, and she came out of that beautifully. We didn't do any antibiotics. We didn't put her in the hospital for 7 days. Can you imagine how expensive that is too?
Oh, geez. Yeah. Probably
But
$15,000 or
oh
something.
my gosh. But this pet parent, you know, again, they don't have an answer. They don't have an answer to what is going on with this dog. And because of this, liver enzymes that have been increased, now she's doing her own investigative work. And now she believes that there is a copper storage issue, which now she thinks that she needs to take the dog off raw. So it's just this craziness that the dog did lose like 7 pounds of weight, you know, over this week. I don't know if this vet's office would actually feed raw. A lot of them won't in a hospital like that. But yeah, it's sort of a mess, sort of a mess. And I don't know, what would you have done in that type of situation?
So the dog just had a fever, did you say? It had
You know,
no
and
other symptoms, or it was just
no.
mainly the fever?
No, it was throwing up. It was
Oh,
throwing up.
vomiting.
Yeah. Throwing up and had a fever, but you know, and obviously wasn't eating, but I don't know. I don't know. So
I mean,
crazy.
usually in a case like that, so if we got a GI thing going on like that, I think fluids are important. If they can't hold down water, they have to stay hydrated. So sometimes just getting the like IV fluids can help, or sometimes subcutaneous fluids are enough. IV fluids are more efficient at keeping the pet hydrated. But I think sometimes like that's all they need. I think part of the problem becomes they go in there and yes, they're put on fluids, but then they're put on anti-nausea medicines or anti-diarrheal. So they'll be on, Sirenia and metronidazole, and then they'll throw in another antibiotic in case it's something else, so that we've got full broad spectrum antibiotic therapy. And I think those drugs just end up making the dog sicker. They don't help. If they had allowed the process to run its course, and of course you want to rule out things like, so doing some imaging is probably a good idea. You want to make sure we don't have a blockage or something serious like that. Dog swallowed a rock or whatever. So you want to make sure that there's not something that could potentially be life-threatening. But otherwise, supporting the body, keeping it hydrated. I use natural anti-nausea stuff, homeopathy like Nux Vomica or tinctures like marshmallow roots, very soothing for the stomach. These pharmaceuticals like the Sirenia that stop the pet from vomiting. You're not treating anything. You're and anytime you're shutting down a process in the body. So this vomiting is telling us something. Something is not right in this dog's digestive tract that it's trying to get out of there. It's trying to detox. And while I agree, we don't want the dog like vomiting continuously because that's hard on the body too. But using some natural anti-nauseas like some homeopathy or some herbs rather than these stronger pharmaceuticals, all of which come with a whole host of side effects, could be some good gentle support and then rehydrate them. I'll tell you, when I had my former clinic where I had the capacity to hospitalize pets and they'd have these GI issues, I'd just bring them in for half a day and put them on IV fluids. And 90% of the time, you just turn them around because they get dehydrated. And once the body's dehydrated, it really can't heal. It's hard for them to turn that corner. And then they're in this vicious cycle because they're dehydrated. So their body's not healing. And then, but they still can't hold down water. So they just can't get themselves hydrated. And then their electrolytes get out of balance. So you give them these balanced electrolyte solutions and just fast them for 12 hours, or 24 hours, just so they don't have to take anything in orally, not even water if you're rehydrating them. And then a lot of times they'll just turn a corner and just be perfectly fine. But this whole thing about the antibiotics, it's like, well, we don't know what's going on. So let's just throw some antibiotics at them just in case. But that's so hard on the body. It's hard on the gut. And you were saying about the elevated liver enzymes, that then the body has to work to process all that stuff. So just the treatments in cases like that can cause the liver enzyme. There may not be anything wrong with the liver. It could just be that the body is trying to detox from all the drugs that it was given, that the dog was given.
Yeah. So I asked, so this was a 15 month old Vizsla. Okay. A 15 month old Vizsla. And she said that she was sick. Basically she was lethargic. She was drinking a ton of water. I only have certain information here, but she was saying that she was drinking tons of water, lethargic, and had this fever. So at first they thought she had lepto, but the test came back negative. The emergency vet, they put her in the hospital for a week, and they said that she had big liver issues, but they don't know why unless they do a liver biopsy. Mm-hmm. And so she's on these antibiotics, and they said that after the lepto test came back negative, then they thought it was something bacterial. So they threw some antibiotics to see if it would help. So I said, well, did they actually find a bacterial, infection? No. Now I did find out that she did no flea and tick, no heartworm, no leptovax. She did do a rabies last summer sometime for this puppy, as you would imagine. But she said it wasn't neurological, that anything that was going on with the dog. She wasn't really eating, but she was drinking a lot of water, hardly moving. And the liver tests were extremely high. But she said the liver tests were getting worse. Now, I'm not sure what that means. And then she said she had a fever for over a week of 105. So I don't know. They also had this dog on some type of liver protector. Because I said, well, did the liver enzymes go up after the antibiotics were administered or these other drugs were administered? And she said, no, they had her on fluids and a liver protector. So that may have been why the enzymes started to go down. So I don't know. It was very confusing, but I'm always suspect when I, it always worries me when I hear that kind of
stuff. You know, when I hear persistent fevers that are that high, I always wonder about autoimmune or some process like that, where again, we have a disruption in normal immune system function. I think that's kind of at the root of almost everything that we treat, because it's the, or the body's, even if you don't say it in terms of the immune system, the body's regulatory mechanisms are just out of whack. That's what I would wonder. And with a temp that high, because I don't think for just a dog fighting an infection or something, usually the fevers don't go that high. They'll go up to 103, but 105, I start thinking about maybe an autoimmune process or, something like that. It's a little long after the rabies shot. Because you said the rabies shot was last summer, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a little, I do definitely see autoimmune disease crop up after vaccines, but I would say usually it's probably within 3 months or so. So a little sooner timeline, but I'd be looking at, is there anything else that dog could have gotten into, or some other environmental toxin that set off a process like that in the body? Cause a fever that high, just a fever that high for that many days could cause a dog to start vomiting. That's a pretty high fever. So the vomiting could have been secondary to the fever, but then what is the body reacting to? But putting on more drugs is not probably the answer.
Well, and I don't know that this would be a copper storage issue. Would that suggest that to you?
I wouldn't say a fever is typical of that. This is another thing where, people go online and they research and they, consult with Dr. Google, and they come up with all of these differentials, but the copper storage thing, that's pretty rare. I mean, that's just not something.
And that's a Vizsla too. We don't see that in
every day. Not typically. Yeah, not typically. So, but I'd wonder about, you know, in some of those dogs, like one of the things I ask, you know, especially in the hunting breeds, is where have they taken the dogs? Because I know a lot of people hunt, especially with the bird dogs, they go into farmers' fields. Well, there's all kinds of chemicals out there that, mm-hmm. you know, and even though they may not be, you know, they're not spraying actively now, but there's still residues in the soil. You know, if they sprayed a bunch of glyphosate out there last year and they're starting, you know, they're going out and trying to work the dogs. So, I mean, I would wonder about something like that, that, you know, just disrupted the body and the normal immune system function.
Yeah. And you and I have seen extremely high liver enzymes, right? Remember a couple of years ago, there was a dog who went in for a neuter and came out and his liver enzymes were off the chart, right? Off the chart. And they told this pet parent, well, I don't think, you know, this is the liver of a very old dog. We wouldn't expect this dog to live. And they came down to the warehouse to pick up food and this dog's running around like a puppy. And I'm looking at it and I'm saying, you know, if you have that kind of a issue, the dog would be acting sick, right? But this dog is doing great today. It's doing great today. So a diagnosis isn't always factual. And you and I have seen some really high liver enzymes. I didn't get the number on this particular dog. But it would be interesting, you know.
What breed was that dog?
Vizsla. This one, the newest one, the Vizsla, the other one that,
The other one with the neuter and the liver enzymes.
I want to say a kind of a labradoodle, but it wasn't a labradoodle. So I don't really know.
There's lots of doodling going on out there.
Yeah,
it
was a doodle of some sort. So that dog's still doing great today.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I see that. I ask about the breed because I've seen this a number of times in Frenchies. Even actually one of the gals that works with me, she has a Frenchie and she's like, well, you know, liver enzymes run really high. And this is the first time that we've done blood work here because she started working with us a few months ago. And the dog's ALT is over 2000. Like, holy crap. But the dog acts perfectly normal. But it doesn't mean that we don't want to do some things to address it, but I'm not putting the dog on, you know, antibiotics or anything because the dog's acting perfectly fine. And it had been recommended to her that she get a liver biopsy and all of this stuff. And I said, you know, the dog's acting fine. Let's just start to do some herbs because I've had good success on these totally asymptomatic dogs with these high liver enzymes using some Chinese herbal blends to get them down. It can take some time. And I'm not sure what exactly is going on that these enzymes go up that high. I mean, obviously something is disrupted in the liver, whether it's, you know, it's not getting normal blood flow, so it can't do its job, or really not sure what the underlying cause is, but I definitely have found that supporting the liver with herbs, you know, we do some detoxing just to help, you know, support the liver. And I do like to do things like ultrasounds because I think ultrasounds they're so non-invasive, and just to get a look at, you know, what does the liver look like? Make sure there's no masses or anything like that going on in the liver. And then if nothing's going on there, and a lot of these cases that I've seen have been young animals, like you were saying, it's like an incidental finding for a spay or neuter or something, and the liver enzymes are high. And it takes some time, but I have seen them come down. And I think what's important is for people to avoid the knee jerk, like, oh my God, cannot feed raw. It's got to be the raw food, right? Liver enzymes are up. Got to be the raw food. Like, it's not the raw food. Raw food's always going to be the best food for your dog. I mean, it doesn't really matter what's going on. Raw food is still going to be an appropriate diet for your dog. I mean, I really, honestly, I cannot think of any medical condition where I would say, don't feed raw. You know, I mean, we might add in other things to support the body and what's going on, but basic nutrition recommendations, as far as I'm concerned, don't change. It needs to be balanced, and they need to be doing the proper rotation. Because I think, as we've talked about, that's, you know, where people get into trouble. They're just feeding one protein because, you know, they've been told that they can't feed, you know, red meat, or the dog can't eat chicken, or whatever the scenario is. And so if the diet becomes too restrictive because they're eliminating certain proteins, or they're eliminating certain ingredients because they read that they've got too much phosphorus or too much this or too much that, I think if people do this variety where they're doing different, lots of different proteins and lots of different body parts and all of this, then you're not going to overdo any one nutrient, I don't think. I mean, is that your approach too, Dee Dee?
Absolutely. And Neely said the same thing. She's like, you know, when people say my dog can't eat raw, she's like, you got to find a way, whether that is to slightly cook it or warm it or feed a cooked diet. I mean, don't go back to kibble. Don't go back to processed food. There's no way that that's going to be beneficial to the dog, right? So again, we never do really understand why some of these recommendations come out. Well, we do understand it, but we were like, you know, banging our heads against the wall, why some of these vets can't get it through their head that these foods are toxic, right? But I want to ask you one quick question, and then I'll let you go. Why would you do a liver biopsy? What are they specifically looking for in a liver biopsy for an animal like this, this one that's, you know, in the hospital? Why would they do a liver biopsy?
I don't think in most cases that information is going to, or the information that you're going to get from the liver biopsy is really going to be that useful. I think imaging. So the reason they do a biopsy is to look at the cells in the liver and, you know, what do they look like? I mean, and if there was, say there was cancer, so say, okay, I'm going to do a biopsy to make sure there's no cancer, that would be pretty obvious on an ultrasound. You got a good radiologist doing an ultrasound. They're going to be able to tell, is there a tumor growing, or they could see abnormalities in the tissue, even if it's not a discrete tumor growing, like they could see abnormalities in the tissue that would suggest, oh, this might be cancer. And then like my approach is, even if we saw something like that, I don't recommend poking needles into cancer, you know, because it makes it aggravates it, and it makes it spread more and grow faster. So I don't advocate that anyway. And anything else, you know, I always ask the question, is the diagnostics going to change our treatment options? Is the information we can get from that diagnostic going to change our treatment options? And if the answer is no, then don't put the pet through it, because it's, I know the gal that works for me, I think she was quoted like $3,000 or something to do a liver biopsy. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. It's, I mean, well, prices are just gotten ridiculously inflated, but yeah, a lot of money. And there's a bleeding risk because you're poking a needle in the liver. And I think, you know, I think liver issues, so like the enzymes going up, can be treated and monitored by doing blood work and looking at the pet. So is the pet sick? You know, we have elevated liver enzymes, and the pet's really acting sick. They're not eating. You know, we have more symptoms going on. Then, you know, we're addressing those symptoms. I just don't think there's much to be gained by a liver biopsy, except, you know, somebody's making a whole bunch of money doing it.
Yeah, that's whoa. I can't imagine how much this pet parent is going to be in debt from a 7-day stay. And, you know, that's the recommendation of the hospital. Now, again, I go back to ASTA. That was the recommendation. Obviously, I had you, I had Neely, you know, that I could bounce these ideas off, and we did something different, and she was fine. But I guarantee you, Dr. Jasek, had I just listened to what the recommendation was coming down from some of the other vets. It was these high powered antibiotics. It was a stay in the hospital. I mean, you know, what I'm saying is that wasn't the be all end all, because I did it my way and she's perfectly fine.
Right. You let her body resolve whatever was going on. And like, we don't know what caused her to run that fever, but her body was processing something. And maybe that fever was just exactly, fever and rest was exactly what her body needed, you know, and fasting. Dogs do self-fasting when they don't feel good. They know, I think sometimes when, you know, especially if they got an upset stomach and, you know, a dog vomits, and it seems like people are so urgent about, well, if my pet would just eat, I'd know they're okay. Well, maybe they're okay if they just don't eat for 24 hours. Maybe that's just exactly what their body needs, because the digestive tract needs to rest. And if the dog ate something or something, you know, dogs eat stuff all the time, you know, weird stuff they pick up outside. And sometimes they get something, it doesn't agree with them. And the best thing they can do is to not eat. Now, they do need to keep drinking. You know, hydration is super important. So if a pet stops drinking, they have to go in and get hydrated. But again, sometimes that's all they need is a fast and some hydration, and just let their body resolve it. I think, you know, medicine has gotten just so messed up, and it's like the veterinarians are just programmed. You know, you have to name something, you have to do all these tests so you can put a name to something. And then once you have that name, then there's an appropriate treatment for that. But they're treating, you know, they're treating like with an algorithm. They're looking at the patient. How is the patient? Because if the patient is running around acting perfectly fine, well, yeah, we don't want to ignore elevated liver values, but this is not a life or death situation. So we need to look at the patient and what's going on. You know, the dog with the fever, again, I'd be looking at, I'd still do the testing, the blood work and, you know, maybe an ultrasound, chest x-rays, just to make sure, you know, there's not more to the picture. But yeah, I'd be thinking autoimmune or something like that going on. That's a pretty unusual case. But I think medicine has just lost touch with patient care. And I think it got so much worse during COVID, where the people couldn't go in. You know, I would find it so much harder to kind of figure out what's going on with a pet if I could not sit and have a conversation with the person, you know, and not just talking on the phone. You know, with COVID, the pets would just go into the clinic and they do all their testing and everything. And then it would be a, you know, 60-second phone call to the person waiting in the car. You're not going to get enough information that way to really know what's going on with the pet. Cause I'll ask questions and then I'll ask another question. And then, you know, sometimes I just see how the pet interacts with the person. Sometimes that gives you a clue. You know, I get this personality thing, you know, cause it all feeds in and I get so much information from that interaction with the person. And I think that has just gotten, I think it was already going by the wayside. And then with the COVID lockdowns where people couldn't go in, it's just gotten so much worse, and it's not getting better. It's not like they're, oh, now we can talk to people about their pets. They're still trying to keep people out of clinics as much as possible.
Oh, I know there's a clinic up here and they're beside our cleaners. And I went to pick up cleaning and they were again in their mask with the people outside. I'm just like, what? Okay. You know, it just drives me nuts, but you can't with all the information that's out there about how big of a hoax this entire thing has been, right? Mm-hmm. People want to hold on to that narrative, and that's fine. Hold on to the narrative, but I personally am not going to leave my dog in anywhere without me. I'm just not going to do it. I just, you know, it worries me, that things can be put in our dogs that we haven't authorized. And then we get made to feel bad because we didn't authorize it. It's like, you know,
Well, it's really messed up. And I think, and this is, and I think it's even more important for people to be advocates for your pets and ask questions, you know, and when it comes to diagnostic testing, I would suggest always asking, well, is this going to change my treatment options? A great example of this are intestinal biopsies, which again, cost thousands of dollars. And the information usually means nothing because they'll come back, oh, your dog has IBD. Well, duh, the dog's had chronic diarrhea. Yeah, IBD is inflammatory bowel disease. It tells us nothing except that the gut's inflamed. Well, we knew that because the dog has diarrhea. What's causing the diarrhea? They get a diagnosis like that and they'll say, you know, conventional side, they'll put the dog on steroids, but that's what they were going to do anyway. You know, it doesn't change any, it doesn't really change any treatment options. It doesn't get you any further down the road. It just drains your pocketbook. And so that, I think that's a real important question to ask, is the information really going to gain us anything? You know, I talk to people about this when it comes to monitoring cancer patients. Say we have, you know, there's a diagnosis, an internal tumor, say a tumor on the spleen or liver, and we're, you know, supporting the pet and they seem to be doing fine. And people will say, you know, do I need to do another ultrasound? And I say, how bad do you want to know? And is it worth $400 to know what's going on in there? Because I'm looking at the pet. And if this pet is doing fine and perfectly healthy, then I feel pretty comfortable saying this is not progressing to the point that it's negatively impacting the pet's quality of life, which in my mind, that's the most important thing. If people want to know what's going on, is it growing? Is it changing? And not that that's bad to know, but as long as the pet's doing okay, tell people, you know, if money were no object, sure, do it. It's non-invasive. But, you know, if you have to choose between doing that test and putting that $400 towards the raw food diet and the herbs and our other treatments, I'd put that money towards the treatments. If the pet, as long as the pet's doing well, if the pet, you know, starts to shift where they're not doing so well, then yeah, finding out what's going on probably be a good idea. But I'd rather see people focus on supporting the pet, doing the therapies, than spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars every month on this testing that really doesn't change what we're doing.
I think that's our next podcast, that we need to help people ask the question, understand why they are asking the question and what to do with that information, because they're so afraid, right? And they mm-hmm. think that, let's just take for answer this liver biopsy. Again, mm-hmm. good question. What is that really going to prove if I do this $3,000 liver biopsy? Is it a life or death situation? Now, mm-hmm. that's the next question that we'll ask on the next podcast, because I've heard many vets say, well, yeah, it could be. And so we want to give them those questions and the next question and the next question so that they can confidently make a decision, not an emotional decision that's going to drain your bank account and not help your pet. Because we see that all the time. And in today's environment, people don't have $10,000, $15,000 just to get, oh, it's idiopathic and we don't have a solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Right. And we or the pets are put on drugs for the rest of their life. Or let's try 3 months worth of antibiotics and, you know, check back in with us then. Let's see what happens. You know, I hear stuff like that all the time and they have no idea even what they're treating. They just feel like, you know, they need to send a prescription out the door and, you know, some treatment protocol and they have no idea what they're treating. And, but that's what they do. And then the pets just end up in worse shape because of all the drugs.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you're down a rabbit hole and yeah,
we'll dive into that rabbit hole next time.
Let's get in it. Alice in Wonderland. Let's go down the rabbit hole.
I like rabbit holes.
Yeah. All right, everybody, check out Dr. Judy Jasek's site on mistletoe. I think it's a fascinating product. We kind of diverted a lot off of there, but it is a great product. If your dog has tumors, if you think you've got a cancer diagnosis, you need a second opinion. Okay, number one. And number two, let's look at some alternatives that work systemically with the body, right? We're not just trying to get rid of that tumor. We're trying to kickstart that immune system. And Dr. Jacek has some amazing products, amazing process, amazing techniques that can help you do that. You're going to find her at ahavet.com. Get your dog on a species appropriate diet. It matters not what issue you are having. You've heard that from all of our experts. They need to have good nutrition. And that's what you get right here at Raw Dog Food and Company, where your pet's health is our business and where friends don't let friends feed kibble. We'll see you next week, everybody. Bye-bye.
Oh, snap.
Find out how you can start your dog on the road to health and longevity. Go to rawdogfoodandcompany.com, where friends don't let friends feed kibble, and where your pet's health is our business.
Just snap.